Chapter 9, The Quest for Clubhead Speed, The New Enemy. As if having your mind stuck in Hoganville isn't bad enough, Golf has stacked on a new enemy, and this time it is an intentional conspiracy. The manufacturers of golf clubs want to sell more golf clubs, so they have promoted the quest for clubhead speed. Modern technology has enabled golfers everywhere to be obsessed with multitudes of data generated by a computer that monitors your swing and spits out numbers and graphs that measure every parameter. But the sexy number, the one that gets every golfer's attention, is club head speed. It means how fast the club head is moving at the moment of impact with the ball. So the faster the club head is moving, the better the swing, and the farther the ball is going to fly, right? No, Mr. Delusional. And the mindless quest for clubhead speed is what leads directly to the axe murderer move. Get the club to the top of the backswing. Now swing as hard as you can. That's got to generate clubhead speed, right? If the ball flies a long way, but into the trees, or water, or out of bounds, that's not a good outcome. Much more important is a swing that consistently produces solid contact. That's the swing you make when you hit your second shot first. We're working our way to that. There's a hierarchy to swing goodness. 1. Good, consistent, solid contact. This is by far the most important. Clubhead speed. 2. This means if you make consistent solid contact with medium or even slow clubhead speed, you'll hit a good shot. If you make good solid contact with more clubhead speed, the good shot will go further. But if the mindless quest for clubhead speed causes you to institute the axe murderer move, you will not consistently make good solid contact. Once in a while, you get lucky and make good contact when you're out of control and hit a good shot. You might be delusional enough to think you've solved the problem, and this result is consistently repeatable, but it's not. I must confess, I'm a sinner too. I'll be playing well, and out of the clear blue as I'm teeing up the ball, I'll say to myself, "Watch this. I'm going to put a little something extra on this shot." It is true that given a swing with perfect solid contact, the faster the clubhead speed, the farther the ball goes. Except the harder you swing, the less likely you are to make perfect solid contact. So a mighty wild swing might produce big-time clubhead speed and end up grazing the top of the ball and result in a 5-inch grounder. I used to play tennis. Tennis players are more realistic than golfers because they are required to play directly against another person. There's something about having the number 6 player on the local high school tennis team completely kick your butt by hitting the ball twice as fast as you that knocks the delusional out of your thinking. I probably wouldn't be able to play at Wimbledon after all. But tennis players have a big advantage. There's not a lot of time between the shots. They don't have time to think about chapter 1 through 5 of Ben Hogan's 5 lessons like golfers do while they're standing in the fairway waiting to hit their second shot on a par 5. Maybe I should try a weaker grip, a golfer might ponder as he stands on the par 5. Hogan mentions that in chapter 1. It avoids hitting a hook. But I've got to remember to get that club hit speed. This guy's the king of the slicers. Hasn't hit a hook in 10 years, and doesn't need to hit this shot all that far. He's laying up on a par 5. Thinking about changing your grip does not occur to a tennis player standing at the net while his opponent tries to hit him with the ball. Observation. What's the area where amateur tennis players choke the most? By far, the serve. Especially the second serve. It's the most like golf. Too much time to think. The tennis player turns into a golfer. He bounces the ball endlessly while thinking about all the steps required to execute a serve. Right into the net. Now take this same person and put them on a golf course. Every shot becomes the second serve. It's not the person, it's the game. Because age and injury convert this person into a golfer, he becomes temporarily insane. The temporary part is the time he is on the golf course. Now this guy is obsessed with club head speed. He saw the commercials, Bryson and Dustin and Justin and Jason, Jordan and Ricky and Rory, swing the newest drivers in slow motion. Then they swung in fast motion. The ads show animated X-ray vision views of exploded schematics of the clubs. The commercials feature attractive models of both sexes. You can tell they are scientists because they are wearing glasses and lab coats. They're designing the clubs in clean rooms suitable for microchip fabrication. That must be good. The clubs are made out of titanium and tungsten and carbon fiber and other exotic materials. One of the brands features jailbreak technology. The marketing people must have figured that name would make the paunchy rebels without a clue at the golf club think they were getting so much club head speed it's borderline illegal. All the clubs have dynamic something or others in lower MOIs and COGs. Nobody knows what that means, but it sounds good. Give me some of those COGs, man! Then the TV returned to live action. Bryson is in trouble. He just hit the ball too far. He drove over the green on the 340-yard par 4. The guy watching TV thinks, I gotta get some of that club head speed. After all, isn't the whole deal about how far you can hit the ball? Chapter 10, Developing Club Head Speed. Here's a list of what the average golfer has in common with Tiger and Bryson and Brooks and Rory and Ricky and Jordan and Justin and Dustin and Hideki. Nothing. But this does not prevent the golfer from thinking he can hit the ball just like those guys. First on the list of improving club head speed for the well-heeled golfer, buy a new driver. That will improve my club head speed. Why didn't I think of that? Thank you, TV ad, for the public service of pointing that out. Well, I used to play in a serious league with a guy who bought a new driver every spring. Now, by serious, I mean you had to make all your putts. No gimmies. Every year, this golfer announced whenever we were in the same foursome, I'm telling you, I can hit this driver 30 yards farther than my old driver. We didn't like each other that much. I've accurately reported some of my personality shortcomings. I played in that league for 5 years. And one time I told him, hey, since you were hitting your drives about 200 yards when we started playing, and you've added 30 yards every year, you should be up to around 350 by now. Even though he was still hitting his best drives, maybe 200 at that time, he didn't seem to appreciate my well-reasoned comment. More on that guy when we get to practice swings. Discussion question 1. How many drivers do you own? Do you store them in different places in your house, garage, trunk, or your car? Maybe just the heads of the drivers in a safe deposit box so your spouse can't get an accurate count? Despite all the evidence to the contrary, are you delusional enough to think that buying the next one, you know, the one with the increased MOIs, will be the answer to all your golfing troubles? Bonus question. Have you ever tried to trade in one of your old drivers to find out it's worth just $5? And that's only if you use the credit to buy a new driver? Who do they think they're dealing with anyhow? Chapter 11, Club Head Speed, Part 2. Whether or not a golfer could afford a new driver, there's one certain way to improve club head speed. Swing real fast. Yep, get up there and swing as hard as you can. That's got to improve your club head speed. Speed means fast, right? Let's compare the average guy to the best athletes in the world. The great golfers, even the fat guys, have fantastic hand-eye coordination. They're the guys who pitched no-hitters in Little League while hitting 2 home runs and eating a hot dog on the bench between innings. Many of these guys were recruited to play more than one sport in college. Does that describe you? Did you ever see the pros fooling around with a wedge in their hand, bouncing a golf ball off the face into the air multiple times? It seemed they can do it all day. They look like they're playing with the toy marketed as Bolo Bat, the paddle with a rubber ball attached to an elastic band. How many times can you bounce the ball up in the air off your wedge? I can sometimes do three in a row, but the third one is an off-balance lunge which barely nicks the ball and eliminates any chance of a fourth. You don't want to stand near me when I'm trying this. I bet that's still better than you. My email address is in the book. If I'm wrong, send me a recording of your bouncing the ball off your wedge, and I'm savvy enough to detect if you're video looping the same hit repeatedly. A lot of amateur golfers can't do one in a row. If they try this drill, they look like Mel Brooks as the governor in Blazing Saddles trying to do the bolo bat, who also couldn't hit one in a row. Back to golf. These same guys think swinging super hard with their drivers is going to improve their club hit speed. There are two things wrong with this philosophy. One, starting the downswing as fast as you can often results in actually slowing down by the moment of impact because you're out of control and subconsciously decelerate so you don't whiff on the shot. And number two, an out-of-control wild man driver swing doesn't usually result in solid contact with the ball. Even great club head speed combined with hitting the ball off the top or bottom or toe or heel of the driver never ends up with the ball 280 yards out in the middle of the fairway. Remember that solid contact is the most important part. Sometimes it's a pop-up to the ladies' tee. At the course where I play, the first tee is next to the driving range. A lot of these wild man swings end up with the ball in the driving range. It's fun to see the perpetrators look for their ball among the hundreds of range balls. I never help them look. It's their fault they hit the ball over there. Just hit one of them. Any ball, I helpfully yell. Admittedly, I'm not the nicest guy to play with. I hate slow play. More about that later. Are you beginning to get the message? Don't try to play like the pros. Repeat after me. I shot 103 today. I'm not going to wake up and shoot 68 tomorrow. To consistently break 90, you don't need to hit the ball real far. You need to hit it straight, not hit any terrible shots, and have a good short game. If you get in that groove, you might break 80 a couple of times a year on a good and lucky day, or 40 for 9 holes, which is fine. But you're not listening to me yet. That will never work, you think. You still want to swing fast. And if you are going to swing forward real fast, you might as well have a real fast backswing, too. So the reasoning goes. Do I have to hit you with a stick to make this point? One problem. You're not a world-class athlete. Tell the truth. When was the last decade you did a push-up? Important disclaimer. My legal team is advising me to tell you that I am not recommending that you do a push-up or even try to do a push-up, and I am not liable for any resulting injuries. Guess what happens when the non-world-class athlete swings real hard? He loses his balance. You see guys falling forward, slipping backward. You see the occasional whiff, what Gary Player calls a fresh air swing. I've seen guys swing so hard they fell down. You don't see PGA players falling down. The maximum physical exertion technique worked for Russian Olympic hammer throwers, not so great for golfers. When you lose your balance during a swing, you are very unlikely to hit the ball on the sweet spot of the club. You can tell when you do hit it on the sweet spot. It makes a pleasant click. When you miss hit the ball because you are swinging too hard, it makes many different sounds. None of them are pleasant. As part of the extensive research for this book, I've watched YouTube videos explain in technical terms how to develop more club head speed. The following is true. One of the videos took 17 minutes to analyze the first 10 inches of the downswing and the differences between a scratch amateur golfer, a male PGA player, and a female LPGA player, just during this section of the swing. I hung in there and watched the whole thing. Maybe the most boring 17 minutes of my life. The comparison threw off more telemetry and graphic data than the Jet Propulsion Laboratory gets during a landing of a Mars rover mission. My conclusions? One, I can't do it the way the pros do it without hurting myself. Two, it's a matter of timing, not swinging your hands faster. And three, The LPGA player swung her hands way slower than the scratch amateur male golfer, but generated significantly more club head speed at the point of impact because of her almost perfect timing. And she hit the ball farther than the amateur scratch golfer. By the way, the woman was short and petite. The amateur golfer was a strapping guy, maybe a foot taller than her. But she had perfect rhythm. Timing, eh? Another observation I made while doing the thorough, intensive research for this scholarly work, there are thousands, millions, billions, anyhow, many hours of instructional golf videos on YouTube. The videos range across a very broad spectrum. One genre features women with terrific bodies and skimpy clothing, not seen in any golf courses I played. If you are caught watching them by your significant other, you may have a hard time convincing her that you were viewing solely for the golf instructional content. On another lonely end of the spectrum, there are a few videos with people in laboratories using pointers to demonstrate things like dispersion patterns of five irons hit in different humidity conditions. The tone of these videos is very serious. Like a 1950s hygiene film your gym coach may have shown the all-male audience. The message of both genres, don't let undisciplined actions ruin your life. Since I know you're not going to spend any time with the lab coat boys, let's discuss the scantily clad women golf videos. Once you get past the outfits, you may notice that they can hit the ball better than you. A whole lot better. They would kick your butt. They're not stronger than you, they swing slower than you, and they hit the heck out of the ball. These women swing real smooth. They do not look like they're trying to chop down a door with an axe. When the club contacts the ball, it produces a nice click every time. Timing, eh? Let me break some other news to you. If you met any of these women in real life, they would not be interested in you. If you attempted to speak to them, they would call security. Not that I have any personal experience in this. It's just that a friend of mine... Oh, well, I don't want to embarrass him. Email me. I'll send you his name. Here's a quote from Rob Labridge in the book, The New Swing Thought, Mastering the Ultimate Golf Swing. A slower swing requires more strength, while a faster swing calls for more coordination and finesse. We're going to analyze that statement a few ways. First, if you're going to swing fast, you must possess coordination and finesse. You have to be a person who can bounce the golf ball off the face of your wedge multiple times. If you don't have that type of athletic skill, you are going to swing in a different path every time you swing hard. You may not think I know you, but I do. Not only can you not do the wedge ball trick, sometimes you don't have the coordination to lift a French fry from the plate to your mouth without spilling ketchup on your shirt. Be realistic. If you have ketchup stains on any of your shirts, pay close attention to what I'm saying, and you might want to consider buying red shirts for their camouflage value. My experience is that maroon is a good color choice because ketchup tends to darken as it ages. The harder you swing, the more likely you are to get yourself off balance, and the less likely you are to reproduce repeatable solid contact. You know, when the ball makes a sweet clicking sound? Once in a while, you make good contact and hit a good shot. Most of the time, you won't and will hit grounders or slices or sky balls, put the ball in the trees or water, and sometimes you'll miss the ball entirely. So, try to make a great sound when you hit the ball. Don't think about swing speed. How about this for an experiment? Next time you play, don't watch the other guys in your group tee off. Turn away and just listen. You can hear when they hit a good shot. You can hear when they sky the ball. You especially can hear when they hit a grounder. When you hear a nice click, the ball will probably be right in the middle of the fairway. So that's your quest. What do you have to do to create a swing that produces repeatable swing clicks when you hit the ball? But for the average guy, there is so much conflicting buzzing in his brain thoughts that what often results is the I give up. Once in a while, this works swing. We're going to start breaking down the conflicting thoughts. This is your key pathway to a brighter future. Discussion question 1. Do you spell the name of the condiment ketchup or catsup? Either way, it looks the same on your shirt. Have you noticed I mention French fries often? Discussion question two. Did you ever watch any of those golf videos on YouTube with featuring the women but not primarily for the instructional value? Discussion question three. Have you noticed that a large percentage of male golfers who reach a certain age tend to favor cargo shorts? Do they think these pantaloons, in combination with their skinny chicken legs, make them more attractive to the opposite sex? Or does the AARP just send out a free pair of cargo shorts with annual membership renewals? Suggested rule change. I said I'd bring up that guy who bought a new driver every year. This time it's regarding practice swings. He and many others have an elaborate and time-consuming pre-swing routine. In his case, he stood 90 degrees from his intended swing path and took two full, slow-motion practice swings. He held the finish like he was posing for the cover of Golf Digest. Then he stood next to the ball and took another three slow-motion practice swings. Every shot. In cases like this, if the golfer in question then hits a grounder or slices one into the woods, all the other members of the foursome, one after another, are required to point out that he could have hit that shot with fewer practice swings or no practice swings. If he failed to eventually get the message, you are carrying the extra putter. Related situation. The player who tortures his playing partners with too many practice swings on the fairway seemed to come to an almost complete stop when he gets to the green. I think this is caused by watching the pros on TV. After a few holes of watching this guy circle the green, crouch down, plumb bob, and take four times as long as any other player, I helpfully say, "You're going to miss the putt. So can you just go ahead and put us all out of our misery, please?" This almost always works. After the guy misses and we're trying walking to the next tee, I then say, there are scientific studies proving for amateur golfers there's an inverse relationship between how long they take to putt and how often the putt goes in. I'm bluffing. As far as I know, there are no studies like that. Bonus question. Are you telling the truth about question two? Remember, nobody's going to see your written answers. Ethics question. Do you agree with the following statement? Every scene in Blazing Saddles offends some person, persons, or group. Give examples. Chapter 12. A discussion of the sociological roots of our problems. Is it a requirement that every female on the Golf Channel have an English accent? I have nothing against the women individually, but since every decision made by a TV network has to do with ratings and thus money, older American men, the key demographic, must be attracted to women with British accents. Aussie and Kiwi accents are also acceptable. It is attractive, I must admit, but the real reason has deeper roots. In gender fairness, an overwhelming percentage of men, especially on CBS's golf coverage, have similar accents. Let's assume that they're really from the British Isles, or at least some country that at one time celebrated the Queen's birthday, and that they're not faking the accent. If Jim Nance starts talking like John Houseman, we'll know we're on to something. Sir Jim Nance, the Masters Tournament presented you by the cast of Downton Abbey. Further evidence. English lingo, as spoken in England, is increasingly creeping into the TV coverage. Notice homegrown American announcers calling a hole a five par instead of a par five. Do the guys in your Wednesday night nine-hole league call it a five par? Do you say, "Let's pass on to the five par, Uncle Nunzio"? It's obvious that the TV networks think Americans assign more credibility, more gravitas to golf announcers with British, Irish, Commonwealth accents. But that also carries with it the whole guilt baggage, the topic of my next chapter. Discussion question one. Yeah, I know it's officially not the British Open, but the Open Championship. It's fine for people in the British Isles to call it that, but don't you think it's pretentious for Americans to call it the Open Championship? Discussion question two. Did you ever play golf with anybody named Nigel? Me neither. Chapter 13. the role of guilt in a golfer's busy mind. I've got to get a little academic on you for a few minutes, but it will really help you in understanding all those thoughts rolling around in your too busy mind. Remember that golf was invented in Scotland, then made popular by Englishmen, then it spread over to Ireland. I'm not making this up. At that time, religion in Scotland was dominated by the teachings of someone named John Knox, who preached a doctrine called determinism. Not only were you a guilty sinner, but some people were predestined before birth to go to hell, no matter what they did. You are guilty even before you shamefully hope for your opponents to hit bad shots. I do subscribe to one version of predestination for putting. It's either destined to go in or it's not. Just hit it. Then golf spread to England with the snobbery of class structure. Victorian gents were taught that you always cheered for an opponent, for example. Winning on the sporting field wasn't that important. You were still going to have servants at the end of the match to lounder and press your knickers. Good show, Nigel. Golf made it over to Ireland. Grim repressed guilt is one of the vital national industries of Ireland, so they added their own brand to golf along with the consumption of Guinness and Jameson. Non-Christians aren't exempt. I played with enough Jewish guys, for example, to know they have their own guilt burdens as well. So what does this have to do with golf? The Judeo-Christian ethic is working against you. I don't have enough knowledge of the Eastern religion to comment. Perhaps I will do some research for future editions. When golf made it over to the United States, it was the realm of only the rich. There are tales of very wealthy old guys being driven right down the fairway of golf courses in luxury automobiles by their chauffeurs back in the day before golf carts were available. On the other hand, and the other end of the social spectrum, factory workers were too poor and tired from working 70-hour weeks and trying not to be crushed in the exposed gears of heavy machinery to play golf. Golf got popularized and spread out to the masses in the post-war 1950s. Arnold Palmer, television, and a rising middle class helped, along with President Eisenhower, who made no bones about taking off time to go to his beloved Augusta National and play for a couple of days. His attitude, hey, I won World War II. If not for me, you'd be speaking German. So if I want to play golf, I'm going to. So golf has this curious, unique place in the mind of Americans. It's the only professional sport where players call penalties on themselves. Can you imagine Patriots coach Bill Belichick saying to the referee, excuse me, Mr. Official, but on that play, when we just scored the touchdown, I noticed that we had an illegal formation, and therefore the touchdown should be nullified, and we should be penalized 5 yards from the previous spot. Yet professional golfers are expected to, and frequently do, make calls against themselves. A two-shot penalty on Thursday might eventually cost the player making the cut on Friday or earning several hundreds of thousands of dollars on Sunday. Along with this is the tradition of the pro golfer not admitting that he is playing against other people. He's competing against himself or playing against the course. He never wished that another player would miss a putt on the 72nd hole, even if that miss would award him the tournament victory. Interview will never hear. Amanda, Brooks, what were you thinking as Bryson DeChambeau was lining up this putt on 18 that would have tied you and sent the tournament into a playoff? Brooks, I was hoping he'd miss. You know that's what he was thinking, but we have to pretend that it's not. And that layer of hypocrisy carries over to our amateur game. You start off every round with the conflict of wanting to step on your opponent's throat. But there's a voice telling you that you should be happy for them when they hit a good shot. It affects everything, including your swing. The next two paragraphs are worth more than the token cost of this book, way more. Before you tee off, smile as you hand your opponent or opponents a card, printed like a wedding invitation that says the following. I want to beat you. I will play by the rules and expect the same from you. I will be a good sport and acknowledge when you hit a good shot. But I'm not going to pretend that it makes me happy. I'm hoping for you to hit bad shots, and I feel no guilt about admitting that. I want you to miss every putt. Until you have the cards printed up, carry this book in your golf bag and pull it out and read the above to the opposition. If they ask you if they can borrow the book, forcefully tell them no. Go buy your own copy or copies. Remember, you've written embarrassing things in here. Maybe even today's opponent's names under the section for bad or stupid people. This simple act accomplishes two things. Number one, it takes an enormous burden off your shoulders. Some disciples report that they can literally feel a massive weight floating off their bodies. You are no longer walking around with any of that phony guilt. You're free. We want to rid your mind of useless and contradictory thoughts to get you thinking on the level of a reptile, like an alligator. This will loosen up your body and allow you to have a nice, smooth swing. And number two, people are unaccustomed to being addressed with such honesty on a golf course, or anywhere, really. This strategy should disorient him for several holes, at least until you've won the front nine. Chapter 14. The role of golf magazines in making you stink. There's another layer in the conspiracy. Golf magazines. They're not directly out to get you. They're just trying to make money. I get two major golf publications each month, free of charge. Often they are accompanied by a letter that informs me that this is my last free copy and that I must pay for a subscription to continue getting the magazine. This has been going on for 10 years, and I have never subscribed. I never asked for the magazines in the first place. The magazines are full of articles about new golf clubs. Since the manufacturers of the clubs are important buyers of the ads in the golf magazines, the clubs are all rated great or very great. Sometimes a club may be rated as great for high handicappers and very great for low handicappers, or vice versa. Just once I'd like to see one of those magazines review a new driver. Terrible! You could duct tape a beer can to the end of a broomstick and it would hit a golf ball as well as this overhyped piece of junk. We do recommend the stiff shaft option as suitable for the beginning golfer who wants to use a golf club to kill zombies. Available in right and left-handed senior and ladies models. Wouldn't that be refreshing? But that's probably not going to happen. The other main topics in golf mags are beautiful courses you'll never play and instructional videos. For example, they'll have an illustrated article on Augusta National. What? Do I just call for a tea time? I'm flexible. Any opening for a single next Tuesday morning? No? I'll sell you any chance I have of ever playing Augusta National for a nickel. Please see my email information at the end of the book for instructions on where to send the nickel. PayPal accepted. But instructional articles are accessible to everyone. Before I found true enlightenment, I used to read these articles in order to improve my game by adopting the advice into my increasingly complicated bag of tricks. I remember one called 7 Ways to Tighten Up Your Short Game. By the end of the next round, I was referring to it as 7 Ways to Bleep Up Your Short Game. Let me make it clear. Whoever wrote this article could beat me if they played right or left-handed, or cross-handed, or probably one-handed. So what's the harm in reading this helpful article? Here's one problem. This very same magazine had an article the previous month on some number of ways to fix your short game. The author of this month's article can't say, hey, the guy last month was great. Just go back and read that article. So he's got to say something different. But the big problem is that neither author has ever seen you hit a shot. Maybe you don't need to do something different. I read 7 Ways to Tighten Up Your Short Game. It made sense to me. And I decided to try it when I went out to play the next day. It recommended the hinge and hold short game as used by Phil Mickelson. He's pretty good, right? He might be the best short game artist of all time. And we both play left-handed. So we have a lot in common. Maybe people would be calling me lefty by the end of the next round. I arrived at the public course and paid for a bucket of practice balls. I was planning to hit some hinge and hold 20-yard shots as part of my warm-ups, but I couldn't make myself do that. It seemed like a waste of money to hit only balls 20 yards, so I hit every ball in the bucket with my driver. I wanted to get some bang for my buck. I had read the article. I just implement the hinge and hold when I had my first chip shot during the round. It looked easy in the magazine illustrations. How hard could it be? It's just a chip shot. On the first hole, I needed to hit a 20-yard chip shot. Didn't this work out well? I hit my very first hinge and hold shot, 2 inches. Oh, well, I hit my second hinge and hold shot, and it went over the green. I got an 8 on an easy par 4. I decided to try this hinge and hold garbage for one more hole and see how it worked out. I tried it on the next hole with an easy hinge and hold opportunity, didn't have any confidence, and decelerated as I hit the ball, and it dribbled off a 45-degree angle, leaving me with an 80-foot putt. After that, I tried an improvised mix of the hinge and hold with my old chipping style. We'll christen that the neither fish nor fowl method. That's a very bad idea. I stunk. So then I tried chipping with a hybrid. I stunk worse. On the last few holes, I was so discouraged, I chipped with my putter. The odd thing is that pitching and chipping are the best parts of my game. I don't think about a method. I just hit the ball. So why did I read the article and decide that I needed to change? We'll get back to that. It turns out that Phil does use the hinge and hole method. It also turns out that Phil's father put a practice green in the backyard when Phil was a kid. So he hit about 1 million hinge and hole shots before he got to high school. That's a lot better ratio of practice shots to shots in competition than my ratio the first time I tried this method. Then I found out that Phil is a righty who plays golf left-handed. Turns out we don't have that much in common, and don't call me lefty. Is enlightenment starting to seep into your brain? Maybe you should pick a simple method and stick with it instead of trying to change when you do every time you hit a bad shot or see a new magazine article. It's all that time we have between shots that makes us think we have to try something new, even when we're playing well. Years ago, the CEO of Revlon Cosmetics was asked what business he was really in. That was a trendy thing that consultants asked CEOs at conferences. He gave a great answer. What we manufacture in the factories are chemicals, but what we sell is hope. That's what the golf magazines are selling, hope. Golfers are a fertile market. They have more income than the average person and lots of time on their hands thinking about how they can get the magic that will make them not just a better golfer, they can be Ben Hogan, Jack, Tiger, Jordan. Thinking is a problem for everybody. Golfers have too much time to think. Tiger Woods fired his coach, Butch Harmon, right after he won the U.S. Open in 2002. Tiger wasn't happy with his swing. Did I mention he just won the U.S. Open? Harmon had been his coach since 1993 when he was 18, and Tiger had won 7 of the last 11 major golf tournaments, 8 in total, using the swing Harmon taught him. Naturally, he decided to retool his swing. It wasn't good enough. It turned out that Tiger was influenced by his pal Mark O'Meara, a 2-time major winner himself. O'Meara told Tiger that his swing was too steep or something, and that his coach, Hank Haney, could fix that. I guess they were going to de-steepen the swing that won the most recent U.S. Open and 7 other major titles. Then, using his new improved swing, Tiger didn't win any of the next 10 majors. If there's one message that you take away from this book, here it is. Never listen to any suggestion your friend gives you about improving your golf swing. Remember, your friend, while living with all the conflicting guilt that inhabits the inner mind of most golfers, is trying to sabotage your golf game. Do you honestly think he wants you to get better so you can beat him? Or is it more likely he wants to keep you in golf purgatory, the confusing netherworld where you keep handing him the cash? Maybe Tiger should have just hired Brooks Koepka as a sports psychologist. Tiger, just think about nothing. Tiger, just think about nothing. Discussion question 1. Did you know that in the addition to the hinge and hold method, there's also a swing technique called the stack and tilt? There's another one called the bend over and grab the soap. No, not really. I just made up that last one. Discussion question two. Did you do the math? At the rate Tiger was going when he fired Butch Harmon, he could have already passed Jack Nicklaus as the all-time major champion if he just left his swing alone. Think about this the next time you're tempted to try something new in mid-round. Possible thank you note that historians may sometimes uncover in the National Archives. Thanks, Mark O'Meara. Sincerely, Jack Nicklaus. Discussion question three. What is it about TV commercials that try to tie in golf with unrelated major corporations like electric utilities or accounting firms? You know the commercials I'm talking about. At the end of the ad, the pro golfer spokesperson always curls in a 35-foot putt. The ads are so lame that they are embarrassing. Attention, CEOs. Don't let your ad agency appeal to your healthy ego and talk you into one of these commercials. If you do, please know the people at the ad agency will laugh at you behind your back. The only reason they recommended this is that they couldn't think of a creative way to actually sell your product. Chapter 15, The Role of Cheating in the Modern Game. There is rampant cheating, much of it caused by delusional mindset fostered by golf tradition of the last century or more. You know the guy I'm talking about. He doesn't think he deserved the bad bounce on the last hole. So when it comes time for him to report his score, he says 5. And really believes it was a near 5, close enough, even though everybody knows it was a 6. He pictures himself as a noble, a knight of the course among the barbarians. He's going to report the score he deserves. That ball he whiffed on was merely a realistic practice swing. It needn't be reported, even though he took a divot. The same guy moves his ball in the rough, because if there was any justice, he wouldn't have this terrible lie. He also does the lift his ball up trick, pretending he needs to do so to accurately identify it, but then he puts it back down in a much better lie. After all, it wouldn't do to hit someone else's golf ball. Instead of immediately confronting the cheater, under the new guidelines, the proper way to combat cheating is start cheating more than him. Be outrageous. Example, you know the guy has cheated for the first 4 holes. On the par 4th, 5th hole, you get a bogey. 5. When asked for your score, say 3. When challenged, pull the same trick the cheater always does. Say, start counting on your fingers. I was in the rough in 1. Start mumbling. Then I was more mumbling. Point back and forth while mumbling. Then on the green, yep, it was a 3. Here's something about cheaters. They hate it when other people cheat. You're not a knight of the course. So the cheater will pout, then confront you. That wasn't a 3, he'll say. The proper response, yeah, I know, but you've been cheating all along. My only defense is to start cheating more than you. This always works. But don't expect a lot of small talk during the rest of the round. Discussion question 1. You really didn't want to talk to this guy anyhow, right? Discussion question 2. Consider the entire United States. In 1 week, what do you think the total number is between reported and actual scores? Show your work. Chapter 16. Creating the New You. A Breakthrough. I was half listening to a televised tournament. Jim Nance was speaking to mild-mannered good guy Ian Baker Finch, who never says anything bad about anybody. If the words behave loud on the PGA Tour is moving his ball into the sand trap, Finch might say, the behavior is questionable. When drunken fans are vomiting on the cart path, Ian referred to them as fun-loving patrons. Journeyman pro John Doe, I forgot his real name, was struggling to hold the lead as the tournament came to the closing holes. He looked shaky, like he might go over and join the fun-loving patrons vomiting on the cart path. Nance, Finchy, if you were coaching John Doe at this point, what would you tell him? Baker Finch, I would tell him, don't let others celebrate at your expense. This is from a guy who cheered for everybody's putt to go in. I was surprised. It was uncharacteristic of the kind of comment he usually makes, but it struck me like a bolt of lightning. I thought this advice was something Ian Baker Finch's coach told him when he was young. Fitchie must have some steel in his backbone. He was a top golfer, did win the British Open. Remember this phrase, don't let others celebrate at your expense. It will be important when we get to know you. By the way, Fitchie makes his pleasant pronouncement with his Australian accent. Notice that I haven't mentioned how you should grip the club or stand or swing. That's because I don't always know how I should grip the club or stand or swing. How can I tell you? Let's go back to Rob Laveritz in the book, The New Swing Thought, Mastering the Ultimate Golf Swing. A slower swing requires more strength, while a faster swing calls for more coordination and finesse. And we'll analyze a different part of the quote this time. A slower swing requires more strength. Huh? You mean the Russian hammer thrower move doesn't establish what a strong, rugged, macho guy I am? No. It just makes you hit bad shots. I'm not going to tell you how to swing, but I am going to tell you how to get a good swing tempo. We're going back to YouTube, and this time look for Ernie Els, Louis Oosthuizen, and Fred Couples. What they have in common is a nice, easy swing tempo. Smooth. People say they have an effortless swing. That's a bit of an exaggeration. That would mean those guys don't swing at all. They have to make some effort, but there's no violence in their swings. Be advised, it takes more discipline to swing slow, but slow makes it easy to swing in a consistent path. Swinging like the axe murderer is easier mentally, but it makes it harder to find the ball, unless you completely miss the ball. By happenstance, I was watching a man, I don't know, hit off a practice tee today. His backswing was nice and slow, but when he got to the top of the backswing, he went to full crazy hammer thrower mode. It didn't work. Hey, buddy, you've got to watch the whole video. It's only about 5 seconds long. If you're going to watch one YouTube video, here it is. Swing Beats, Ernie Els Tempo. Try to memorize the tempo. I didn't say try to swing like Ernie Els. You can't do that. But you can swing at the same tempo. That's as far as I can take you for now. I'm going to hand you off to somebody who can help you go further. See the next page. Then I'm going to get you back when we can talk about how to put it all together so you can hit your second shot first. Discussion question one. When you search for the Ernie Els video, did you wander into the scantily clad women golfer section with the intention of going back to Ernie later? Can't I get you to focus for a couple of minutes? Chapter 17. Somebody else that can help you. Instead of buying the new driver, spend the same money on golf lessons. If you can't afford that, take one lesson. Go to somebody and tell them that you want to learn an easy, repeatable golf swing that will stand up under pressure, given your age and physical limitations. Ask around and find a good, realistic pro, not somebody who wants to start you off with 19 pages on how to do the Hogan grip, because the Hogan 5 lessons method is one size fits all. But it doesn't fit all, and you ain't the guy that it does fit, unless you're 6 years old and reading this book, which would be inappropriate. I know a woman who used to be a hairdresser. Hefty, mature women would come in with a picture torn from a magazine of, for example, Julia Roberts, and say they wanted to look like her. Just a hairstyling wasn't going to make that transformation. So don't go to the pro and make unrealistic demands like that. Well, for one thing, if you came in with a picture of Julia Roberts and say you want to look like her, the golf pro might think you're a little strange. You need a different sort of professional to help you in that circumstance. Now we're going to assume that you go to the pro and get a workable golf swing. Here comes the hard part. Discussion question. Can I buy just one more new driver first? The one my friend told me straightens out my slice and adds 30 yards in distance? Then if that doesn't work, I'll try the lessons. Chapter 18. The new you under combat conditions. You've got your new Ernie Els swing tempo. Now it's time to go out and play actual golf. You double bogey the easy par 4 first hole. The second hole is a long par 4. You usually can't reach the green in regulation. The Ernie Els routine didn't work that great for you on the first hole. A guy in your foursome who has the Russian hammer thrower swing got lucky and made a five on the first hole. You're losing to him. This is a critical moment. Maybe it's time to abandon ship and go with the axe murderer swing just for this tee shot. You'll never reach the green with two easy swings. Don't do it. It's time to hit your second shot first. Before I even pull the club out of the bag, I think of the words of Ian Baker Finch. Don't let others celebrate at your expense. Those exact words. It worked for me. You've got to suppress the delusional guy inside you. Here's the revelation. Your goals and expectations change when you hit your mulligan. Let's take this example. You're on the first tee, playing in a little tournament. 20 other players are watching you. For your tee shot, you think about that great shot that you hit last week, maybe 240 yards right down the middle. It was the best shot you hit all year. So you try to do that again. You'll show everybody how good you are. But you can't, on command, replicate the best shot you hit all year. You overswing and pull a mean line drive out of bounds. Now you have to re-tee and hit another shot. The people watching you are getting restless. The next foursome wants you to get off the tee. The result? You hit a good, solid shot. Not the farthest you ever hit the ball, but right out there on the fairway in good position for the next shot. Was there less pressure on you? No. There was more pressure on you. So what happened? You changed your expectations. Your goal was to hit the ball in the fairway, and you weren't worried how far the ball was going to go. So take that, Mr. Expert Yacker. It isn't because the pressure was off. The increased pressure forced you to set realistic goals. It worked for the short game, too. I'm a good chipper, but when I get too clever and try to make an impossible shot, sometimes I chip the chip shot 6 inches. Then the next shot, I resign myself to just getting the ball close to the hole. Guess what? It's a good shot. Why didn't I do that the first time? Note, I play with some nice guys, but nobody is so nice that they give you a mulligan on a chip shot. I gave myself a realistic goal. Your body knows how to accomplish the realistic goal. It's what you practice. Remember that everyone is delusional. By having realistic expectations, you become less delusional. I've done some research here. You did let the different portions of your brain do what they do best. The prefrontal cortex gave you the discipline to execute your normal tempo swing, and the reptilian portion of your brain let your muscles relax and go through the swing without thinking of 27 things you have to do to look like Ben Hogan. Now the important part. How do you force down the delusional golfer and make yourself set a realistic goal on every shot? This works for me. I pretend I've just been a jerk and tried to hit a low-percentage bomb off the tee, and the result was a terrible shot. I convince myself of that feeling. That makes me set the realistic goal. Sometimes I still hit a bad shot. Sometimes I still try to hit the unrealistic bomb. That's golf. But when I have the discipline to take the above steps, and just those steps, I play better. I'm trying to get a higher mental level. I like to eventually attain the Brooks Koepka state of consciousness. So maybe the sequel to this book will be Just Think About Nothing. I thought about Brooks. For him, 3 feet from the hole on the approach shot was a realistic goal. For me, the middle of the green is a realistic goal. As I struggle to attain this higher state, my playing partners will carry cattle prods and be authorized to use them when they see me stray from my normal game. Again, if you know anybody in the electric cattle prod business, I'm open to an endorsement deal. Afterward, as people have become aware that I have written this book, take a guess at what they say to me when I hit a bad shot. Hey, hit your second shot first. So clever. But I did bring it on myself. Also, I describe myself in this book as a self-centered jerk. No one has taken issue with this. My wife read the book. My alleged friends have read the book. Nobody has said, oh, you're being too hard on yourself. Linda, who edited the book, made no pencil marks, no, did you really want to say this? Notations in this passage. If you're writing a review, please do not feel that it's necessary to call me a self-centered jerk. If you must, at least, don't put it in the headline of the review. If you like this book, please take a look at Be Sincere, even when you don't mean it, is really laugh out loud funny. The main character does play in the Masters Tournament, as well as the Super Bowl, is an astronaut, an astrophysicist, competes in the Hawaii Ironman. Don't just take my word for it. Check out the book and their views on my website, JimmyFlynn6.com. All my books are available on Amazon. Sign up for my newsletter at my website, JimmyFlynn6.com.